and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, National Park Service historian Katie Ringsmith presents Wrangell Mountain Sky Boys, How Buffalo Bill, Buck Taylor, and Bob Reeve Created Alaska's Sky Boy Narrative. Hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society, Wrangell Mountain Sky Boys was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on April 18th.
Okay, now we turn our attention to our speaker, Katie Ringsmith, who's a historian at the National Park Service and an adjunct professor at University of Alaska Anchorage's Eagle River campus. She is an author of at least four publications and has worked with the Anchorage Museum as a guest curator for PayDirt, which is the regional portion of the worldwide world travel exhibit Gold that was here for a couple years ago. And she is currently working with the Anchorage Museum staff to curate Sky Boys Making History Above the Wrangell Mountains, which will be a photo exhibit and will supplement the exhibit Arctic Flight, A Century of Alaska Aviation, and then fits right into the theme today. So you get a preview of the history and the information that will be in that exhibit. Katie got her master's degree in Northern Studies at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and then went on to Pullman at WSU to get her PhD in history. Katie has served in the Alaska Historical Society Board of Directors since 2006 and has served as a president of that organization. Tonight, Katie presents a talk on the Wrangell Mountain Boys, how Buffalo Bill, Buck Taylor, and Bob Reeves created Alaska Sky Boys narrative. And please join me in welcoming Katie Ringsmith. And as I turn this over, I want to encourage people that are not members of this organization to join up. And you can find that membership on the back of the program. And also join us after the lecture out in the lobby, and you can have refreshments and speak to one another and also to our speaker. So here I turn it over to Katie. Welcome.
First, I'd like to thank Judy and the Cook Inlet Historical Society for asking me to present to you all this evening. I also want to thank the Anchorage Museum. Judy mentioned that I'll be curating the upcoming Wrangell Mountain Sky Boy exhibit. It'll be on the fourth floor. It's a supplement to the Arctic Flight exhibit that's currently going on right now. And what's kind of neat about this exhibit is there'll certainly be on display some iconic photos I'm sure you'll all recognize, but also on display are some photographs that have never been seen by the public and that I've received them from private individuals. So that makes it really exciting, too. I also want to thank the National Park Service for giving me the opportunity to investigate such great history over the years. Not only have I been able to bring numerous Alaska stories to the wider public while I've been working at the National Park Service, but I've been allowed to share those stories with the residents with whom that history really still matters. It is in the fostering of community relationships that history becomes resoundingly present and personal for me, and no work could be more satisfying. So I thank the National Park Service as well as the community of flyers in the McCarthy area who shared with me their pictures and their stories. So thank you. Now, full disclosure, I am not a pilot. Not at all. I am terrified to fly. I get really nervous every time I hit turbulence. My son throws up on me every time we're in a plane, so I really don't like it. And not going into details, because I think this is good recorded, I have a reputation among the helicopter flying community. When I enter a plane, they give me a barf bag immediately, so no questions asked. So needless to say, this is not an aviation history per se. But it certainly is using aviation as a lens through which we can understand our story of Alaskans and certainly this really wonderful place in Alaska, the Wrangell Mountain area. Now, when I started this study, it certainly started with a few questions. If you Google bush pilot, you will, you know, get websites that pop, hundreds of websites pop up. This one just happened to be one that I found. In the far north country, there is a breed of pilots that are unlike any other on Earth. It's in the wilds of Alaska that men and machines are confronted by two simple questions. Did they safely arrive at their destination? And will they get back? Alaska bush pilots, the real deal. So what is it about bush pilots? I grew up in southwest Alaska. My dad was a superintendent for a cannery. I worked at Katmai National Park. And I can say I've spent a lot of time relying on planes, flying around on planes, whether I liked it or not. And I have to say, there's always something really exciting about planes. There's something about when people are in roadless areas, planes are so important. And admittedly, in my younger decades ago ages, it wasn't so much what those planes were bringing. Sometimes it was who was flying the planes. Turns out, there's a heritage of hero worship that surrounds Alaska bush pilots. And while writing a history of aviation in the Wrangell-St. Elias and National Park area for the agency, I began to wonder exactly why. What is it about bush pilots? During the peak of what Time magazine coined the American century, journalist Beth Day came to Alaska in 1955 to interview a few of the last frontier's famous flyers. At that time, Americans considered airplanes modern marvels. Test pilots like Chuck Yeager personified a new American hero who, since Lindbergh's transatlantic flight in 1927, had pushed boundaries between Earth, space, and sky. In 1947, Yeager broke the sound barrier. That feat, bolstered by World War II military technology, ushered in a new era in commercial aviation known as the jet age. To the average American, even the 1950s era passenger planes like the Douglas DC-3 and the Connie 240 looked like rocket ships. Their old metal design was sleek, streamlined, and aerodynamic. Supercharged turboprop engines lifted these behemoths effortlessly into the atmosphere. Pressurized cabins, automated internal systems, and advanced radio and navigational equipment allowed jetliners to arrive at their destinations with unmatched speed, precision, and comfort. Jet age represented an inevitable future. America looked upward to space, zooming towards what President John F. Kennedy in 1960 termed America's new frontier. Indeed, the Alaska aviation industry represented the best of American technological know-how and in many ways epitomized the media's notion of the American century. Nowhere in the nation was the airplane more important than in Alaska. As historian Robert J. Serling put it, aviation and Alaska were practically synonymous. Air travel dominated Alaska's means of transportation. In 1958, Alaska had only 5,000 miles of roads. Alaskans therefore flew more in proportion to their population than any country in the world. On the eve of statehood, the New York Times reported that besides the local air carriers, Pan American, Pacific Northern, Northwest Orient and Alaska Airlines all operated planes into Alaska, while two international lines, Scandinavian Air and Air France, made regular stops at Anchorage. Given Alaska's circumpolar proximity to Asia and Europe, the article anticipated that Alaska's future was aviation, predicting that its role as a global hub would only grow. With each year, the paper noted, other airlines are coming in. By 1962, Anchorage was known to the entire aviation industry as the crossroads of the air world. Yet, instead of presenting aviators and terms of that modern world, which at the time was represented by the futuristic Buck Rogers, Day evoked a swashbuckling cowboy, Buck Taylor, and what some would claim an old-fashioned and very familiar story of the Wild West. Glacier Pilot, the story of Bob Reeve and the flyers who pushed back Alaska's air frontiers, paints a portrait of the Alaska bush pilot as the endearing symbol of frontier Alaska. Pilots Harold Gillam, Merritt M.D. Kirkpatrick, Merle Smitty Smith, and of course Bob Reeve are presented as pathfinders, cowboys, blazing trails in fixed-wing biplanes, and who could also constitute the cast of a Sam Peckinpah film. Glacier Pilot positioned the bush pilots as the central figure in the opening of Alaska, akin to the figurative Daniel Boone escorting settlers through the Cumberland Gap. Day's words echoed those of New York Times journalist who in 1920 wrote, "Alaska's vast wealth will never know development unless transportation is furnished beyond the fringes of the country. At the present time, the pioneers are wild about relief by airplanes." In Day's narrative, bush pilots selflessly conquered the forbidding last frontier wilderness, despite the risk to themselves. They are depicted as laissez-faire entrepreneurs and pioneers of civilization. They're all male, except for the occasional woman, who in those days flew with Moxie. Like any gunfighter, Alaskan flyers were not afraid of a fight. The most daring opened Alaska's empty land to the mineral development and to mountaineers aiming to conquer the continent's highest unnamed peaks. Contributing to Day's portrayal of the bush pilot was the magical machine with which godlike flyers not only defied the laws of nature, but made it accessible in unprecedented ways. No technology is more important in Alaska than that associated with aviation, wrote historian Roderick Nash. The bush pilot is Alaska's covered wagon. An observer from 1930 marveled, "Nowhere, I believe, does air travel mean more saving of time and effort than in Alaska. A midwinter trail stretching into weeks of hardship becomes a six-hour journey in swift planes." In 1967, U.S. Senator Bob Bartlett remarked, "The early airplanes were mechanical marvels flown by resolute men who became folk heroes in their own time. They were truly pioneers, as were the men who moved into the American West by horse and by ox team, and who drove the railroads to the shores of the Pacific." Writer Stephen C. Levi exclaimed that it was the airplane that brought Alaska into the 20th century. Yet he describes such transformative change using frontier prose. He calls bush pilots the unsung heroes of the North, who by overcoming mountains, glaciers, frigid temperatures and blinding blizzards became the stuff of legends. "These cowboys of the sky," insists Levi, "make Alaska what it still is today." Those inhabiting Levi's legendary Alaska would surely agree that it is an exceptional place. Most Alaskans would describe bush pilots as self-reliant, individualistic, defiant, and rugged individuals. And as a side note, I also describe that as my 3-year-old son. So maybe he's a future bush pilot. I don't know. The perception of bush pilots as modern-day cowboys of the North who embody the frontier spirit of Alaska remains a powerful narrative that not only resonates with the public, but needs no explanation. "I have never encountered anything in aviation quite as unusual," remarked Alaska Airlines historian Robert Serling. "As an airline that technically, economically, operationally, and geographically has outgrown its name and yet refuses to change it." Serling suggests that the very uniqueness of Alaska Airlines' Eskimo Tail insignia sets the airline apart from other carriers by symbolizing the company's heritage, tradition, and its commitment to being a little different from, and often a little better than, anyone else. Clearly then, Beth Day was not alone in her use of the frontier narrative to convey the importance of Alaska aviators to the larger public. Over time, popular culture's fusion of pilots and cowboys has created what one might call, me, the Alaska Skyboy narrative, which has been used to express the historical significance of Alaska aviation to the larger public. Still, it seems strange to me that both contemporary and current writers chose to describe modern aviation using rhetoric that conjures up the quaintness of the 19th century, rather than celebrating pilots and planes as 20th century creations. To put it another way, why Buck Taylor and not Buck Rogers? So here's my theory as to why. Before World War II, the aviation in Alaska involved a very small fraternity of flyers. During the peak of Alaska's golden age of aviation, a period lasting roughly between 1924 and 1938, only a handful of people piloted airplanes. Even fewer flew in them, and fewer less understood how it all worked. Scribes of the day lacked a neatly packaged narrative to express the complexities of this new industry. No simple storyline existed that fully explained to the average reader how this new technology might shape their future without borrowing triumphant language from a plotline contained in Alaska's Last Frontier narrative. In 1936, for example, New York Times writer Calvin S. White wrote, "Lacking the faculties for other travel around found in many regions, Alaska proves to claim to the title of America's flying frontier. Sourdoughs will always remember the epic dog team dashes of the past, but for everyday travel in 1936, they depend on the airplane. On the pilot," White concluded, "depends the future of America's Northern Empire." But this was a bit of an exaggeration on the New York Times part, for not everyone was flying in the early 1930s. Most people interest in aviation was like our interest in NASCAR. It was entertainment. They're just waiting for the crash. No one wanted to get into an airplane. Ask Bob Reif. He was like, "I'll give it, you know, fly up for free." And they're like, "No, thank you. I just want to see you crash." Serling writes that it's one of history's great ironies that the nation where heavier-than-air flight was first achieved was the last major industrialized country to realize the commercial potential of the airplane. Bush pilot Oscar Winchell discovered this the hard way. When he was seeking a flying job in 1931, the consensus at the time, pilots were nuts. No one wanted to get in a plane. So the mixed sentiments that pilots were either gods or crazy or a little of both made articulating the experience of flying particularly challenging. It was like trying to explain magic or giving birth. Few Alaskans, or Americans for that matter, really understood the dizzying technology. No one could articulate or accurately express flying's element of wonder without the platitudes. For their cold weather services, such as carrying the mail, assisting miners, or saving lives, a reporter for Alaska Life called Alaska aviators angels in fur. And by using 19th century narrative to explain 20th century modern flight, authors and journalists were able to put into words, to describe to all us non-flyers, the indescribable. But most importantly, underscoring the image of the Alaska Skyboy was America's bleak outlook during the Great Depression. Words that expressed progressive era optimism, such as efficiency and ingenuity, were used less and less during the 1930s. For many believed that technology and modernity itself had caused the nation financial woes. And it's well documented that the Depression-era society tended to look more to the past than towards the future. To make aviation's unknown role meaningful to weary readers, writers of the day utilized a common, highly popular narrative that ignored the technical, the future, and instead focused on the charismatic pilots and the more fascinating aspects of aviation, the risk and danger, selfless heroism, the freedom, not to mention the ability to explore new territory, conquer nature, and defy gravity. As Copper River homesteader Sammy Gallagher expressed in 1931, "I was 19 and in love with Harold Gillam." Who wouldn't have been? So, besides providing a kind of escapism, Alaska Pilot showed what man and machine could accomplish together. So even though aviation epitomized American modernization in a world increasingly dominated by industry and machines, seemingly sapping the life out of American farmers and laborers, Skyboys lifted spirits. They gave non-flyers hope that they too could be self-reliant, rugged, and most importantly, captains of their own fates. When Beth Day arrived to Alaska, the last frontier in 1955 to research Glacier Pilot, the Skyboy narrative was securely fixed in the popular imagination. The ease of which a century of writers and journalists like Day could evoke the frontier and its most iconic characters, the Skyboy, or the cowboy, begins in 1893 during the Chicago World's Fair, when historian Frederick Jackson Turner and the flamboyant showman Buffalo Bill Cody each told compelling stories about the American frontier. In the years between the purchase of Alaska in 1867 and the fair in 1893, the average American considered Alaska an icebox or Seward's Folly. The Chicago Fair, however, initiated the first shift in collective thinking. There, Turner gave his essay, The Significance of the Frontier in American History. Because his sweeping explanation resonated with the American people, Turner's version of American history spread easily among professionals and popular audiences alike. Meanwhile, exhibited not far from where Turner introduced his frontier thesis to the nation, Buffalo Bill Cody's public extravaganza, Buffalo Bill's Wild West, claimed to be a correct presentation of life on the plains. Among Cody's colorful cast of settlers, scouts, and Indians was the cowboy, the Wild West's most enduring figure. Cody took a Texas cowpuncher named William Levi Taylor and introduced him as Buck Taylor, King of the Cowboys. Cody crafted Taylor as a wandering soul who longed to return to his rustic life on the Great Plains. Portrayed as a plain-spoken Westerner, Buck Taylor's life on the open range made him somehow more genuine than pampered Easterners. Audiences embraced Taylor's performance, and his popularity grew, so did America's interest in the cowboy. Cody's invention of the American cowboy was no small feat, for before his promotion of Buck Taylor as a featured performer in his shows, the public perceived cowboys as drunken, rambunctious wrestlers who disregarded private property, law-abiding citizens, and the maintenance of the peace. The historic cowboy was likely an ex-Confederate, the son of a drifting fallen soldier. Of the 35,000 men who worked as cowboys, about 25% were African American, another 12% were Mexican. Instead of saving damsels and small towns from black hat wearing wranglers, the historic cowboy was a hired hand employed to tend cattle. His work was dirty, his hours long, his pay pitiful. The invention of Buck Taylor idealized the cowboy. He was courageous, honorable, chivalrous. In psychological terms, Cody's cowboy symbolized not so much what America was, but what America imagined itself to be. Moreover, the cowboy king, like the frontier he inhabited, was vanishing. Historian Richard White suggests that Cody's frontier story conveyed a message of eventual decline, for his cast of characters memorialized a list of lasts. The last real Indian, the last herd of buffalo, the last real cowboy. Ironically, notes White, the cowboy became an American symbol in the very era that announced the end of the West and the closing of the frontier that created him. both storytellers, Turner and Buffalo Bill, warned that the sun was setting fast on the open frontier, but the cowboy rode on long after the multitude of last Wild West encores ceased. The character of the cowboy began to appear more frequently in melodramas and popular fiction, most enduringly in Owen Wister's The Virginian in 1902. By the turn of the century, the strenuous life typified by Theodore Roosevelt, America's first cowboy president, coupled with the progressive era's desire to toughen up America, accounted for the growth, development, and spread of the Western as a literary form, as well as the adoption of the cowboy identity in American life. Then, in 1897, just 4 years after the Chicago Fair, an event occurred that melted Alaska's icebox image from public perception forever. At that time, the nation faced a serious economic depression, so when 68 Klondike miners and $1 million worth of gold sailed into Seattle, it sparked a rush of gold seekers to the far north. The wild stories circulating about the size and extent of the Klondike discovery not only represented opportunity for down-on-their-luck Americans, but writers at the time began to link America's northern territory to the nation's frontier saga. Almost overnight, Alaska's image as an icebox was replaced with the image of the land of vast natural wealth. Recognized now as a storehouse, Alaska had become the last frontier, and its face, the sourdough, was the invincible prospector. In 1913, on the eve of the Shoshana Gold Rush, just 1 month after Alaska's first flight took place in Fairbanks, the Chitna leader reported that Cordova boosters were so impressed with the possibilities of air flight that they devised a plan to fly prospectors from their coastal town to booming Shoshana, located on the other side of the Wrangell Mountains. Now, exactly why the first air carrier commuter service in the Wrangells never materialized in 1913 was not explained in the article or by the paper, but the lack of airfields and supporting infrastructure was the likely reason. Although flight service to Shoshana gold camps would not be established for another 17 years, the promise of aviation, overcoming Alaska's expansive wilderness barriers and opening the Alaska frontier storehouse to development, had been sparked.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with National Park Service historian Katie Ringsmith. Her talk, entitled Wrangell Mountain Sky Boys, How Buffalo Bill, Buck Taylor, and Bob Reeve Created Alaska's Sky Boy Narrative, was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on April 18th.
From the turn of the century onward, Wrangell Mountain miners sought copper, for it was being used at an unprecedented rate to electrify the nation. But the real catalyst for aviation in the Wrangells during the 1930s was gold, especially after President Franklin Roosevelt raised the price from $21 an ounce to $35 an ounce in 1933. The increasing demand for faster transportation to the remote mining districts of McCarthy, Nezina, Nabesna, Shoshana, and Bremner eventually formed the primary stops along the Copper Belt line. By the early 1930s, bush pilots had replaced the sourdoughs as the face of the frontier. And to a nation plagued once again by economic despair, Alaska and its aviators were thrust into a potent role. They became symbols of opportunity, freedom, and most of all, hope. Harold Gillam, Bob Reeve, Kirk Kilpatrick, and Merle Mudhole Smith, they were part of Alaska's elite fraternity of Sky Boys who established air service in eastern Alaska in the 1930s. Writers describe Harold Gillam as the strong and silent type, who was apparently quite popular with the ladies. The supposed, and I say that's in quotes, great love of his life was Marvel Crossan, Alaska's first female pilot, and Joe Crossan's sister, who died during an all-female cross-country air race flown against the likes of Amelia Earhart. Not only did Gillam pioneer reliable air service into the mountain region, but he was famous for his pet polar bears, his cat-like vision, and his uncanny ability to fly in weather, known as Gillum weather, that kept most flyers grounded. Mostly, Gillum was known for using his remarkable flying skills to save people's lives. In December 1934, the Valdez Miner reported that owner of the Demesda mine, Carl Whitman, had died from injuries incurred during a fall down a mine shaft, despite Harold Gillum's emergency flight out to the mine in a 35-mile-an-hour wind. A week later, the paper reported that Whitman was actually alive and that the report of death was, quote, very much exaggerated. Now, no wonder these pilots were considered angels in fur. They could resurrect people from the dead. So because Kennecott had the only modern hospital in the Copper Belt region, the regional miners, they instead of, the owners, instead of just letting their miners die, they said, well, let's try to save them. And so they had an agreement that they could fly to the mine, and they would actually attend to the injured and the sick, and that made the strip at McCarthy really important to that area. The penniless Bob Reeve supposedly drifted into Valdez in 1932 and started flying miners to hard-to-reach claims located in the remote peaks of the Chugach Mountains. Like a kind of scout of the sky, Reeve used his Fairchilds to prospect for undeveloped mineral deposits, aptly naming his own mine the Rough and Tough Mine. The pilot nearly monopolized service to regional mines by perfecting a method of mudflat takeoffs and glacier landings that few were willing to try, let alone accomplish successfully. The meticulously clean Harold Gillum once said of Reeve's filthy flying, Reeve can have it. Now, Reeve was pretty dirty in other ways, too. In the mid-1930s, pilots made use of local papers to conjure up business, and when the paper reported a daring feat by the competitor, Gillum came in the other night in the dark and made a landing, but the field needs floodlights to guard against accidents. Well, Reeve would capitalize upon the reader's apprehension. Maybe I don't want to be flying with Gillum in the dark when they need floodlights, by putting his own advertisement right below the article. Always use Reeve Airlines or Airways just when the reader could see it. Valdez readers were also captivated by a serial authored by Bob Bennett entitled Caught in the Wild, where sky boy Alan Garth, who looked a heck of a lot like Bob Reeve, saves the lives of three pampered Easterners while they plot to take his. By the mid-1930s, Reeve had gained attention beyond Alaska. Celebrated writer Rex Beach came to Valdez, after which he wrote several articles promoting Alaska mining that highlighted Reeve's mudflat expertise. The inspired writer even patterned his lead character on Reeve, whom he called the Flying Ptarmigan, in his 1939 novel, Valley of Thunder. For his flying and apparently his good looks, the soon-to-be famous war correspondent Ernie Pyle called Reeve the Adonis of Alaska aviation. In 1937, famed explorer Bradford Washburn sought a pilot to fly his climbing party and gear to the Walsh Glacier at the base of Mount Lucania, the highest unclimbed peak in North America at the time. Reeve replied to Washburn's request in typical Reeve fashion. Anywhere you ride, I'll fly. Washburn's narrative of the harrowing expedition, later published by Life magazine, touted Reeve as one of Alaska's great bush pilots and contributed to his fame moniker, the Glacier Pilot. Merle Smith was really more of a promoter than a cowboy. Born in Kansas, he entered aviation as a barnstormer in the Midwest. In the 1920s, barnstorming, as I mentioned, was a popular form of entertainment in which pilots like Smith performed stunts and tricks with airplanes and a group called the Eiman Brothers Flying Circus. Barnstorming, however, was a tough way to make a living, so Smith came to Alaska in 1937 to work for Kirk Kirkpatrick, who had recently started Cordova Air Service in 1934, primarily to serve the Bremner Gold Mining Company. Based out of McCarthy, Smith spent several years as a working stiff flying mining supplies on scheduled flights to the mines all around the Copperbelt line. It's also at Bremner in the C-2B, the Stearman, which is actually right upstairs, that same plane. That's where he landed at Bremner Mine, hit a mud hole, and Bob Reeve heard the story, and the legend forever. That's when he became known as Mudhole Smith. In 1938, Smith flew Ernest Greening on an aerial tour of the Chittenah Valley. Alaska future governor was the director of the Department of Interior's Division of Territories, and at the time worried that the ensuing pullout of Kennecott and its railway would negatively affect the region's economy. That September, Greening recommended that the Chittenah Valley be added to the National Park Service system as the Kennecott National Monument. The threat of war, however, put any discussion of a national park on the back burner, but nevertheless, Greening did set the precedent for tourism becoming the region's new economic engine decades later. In the spring of 1939, Smith suddenly, and for very tragic reasons, became president of Cordova Air after his friend and boss, Kirk Kirkpatrick, departed from McCarthy during a spring snowstorm and fatally crashed in a bay near Cordova. Within a few years, Smith bought out each of the Cordova Air investors and later reincorporated as Cordova Airlines. Meanwhile, federal regulation of the aviation industry came in 1931, and that really ended the so-called Wild West of aviation in Alaska. Pilots like Bob Reeve opposed increased government interference, while Harold Gillam, on the other hand, saw regulation as making flying safer and, in the end, more profitable. Now, adding to Reeve's difficulties, by the way, he's smoking and fueling his plane. I don't think that's such a smart thing to do. adding to Reeve's difficulties, he was without an airplane during a period of time that the CAA granted regional pilots routes in which the legislation termed the grandfather clause. At a CAB meeting held in Anchorage in 1939, Reeve famously testified against federal regulation, warning that in Alaska, it was only the rustler who survived. Nevertheless, the defiant Bob Reeve was out of the Wrangell Mountains. And actually, it was a good thing, because in 1941, Reeve returned, transitioning from cowboy to war hero. Government contractor Morris Knutson hired Reeve to fly supplies for the construction of the Northway Airfield, a vital midway point between Whitehorse and Fairbanks in the military's cross-continental lend-lease program. Reeve flew his Fairchild 71 round the clock from Nabesna Landing Field at the end of the Richardson Highway road system to the roadless Northway site 60 miles away. By summer 1941, Nabesna Landing Field had become one of the biggest in Alaska, shorter only than Elmendorf and Ladd Field. To quicken the pace of the flying operation over the mountains, Morris Knutson ordered a new plane from Boeing, an ADA modeled. The pilots dubbed it the Yellow Peril because I guess it had really bad brakes. The ADA was designed to haul 4,000 pounds, but Reeve managed to fly 7,000-pound loads with the aircraft. And by mid-November, just a few weeks before Pearl Harbor, Reeve had flown in 1,100 tons of construction supplies and over 300 workers that amounted to a usable airstrip. In spring 1942, the Northway Airfield construction recommenced. Morris Knutson hired Harold Gillam, who took over the Nabesna Northway Airfield construction project after Reeve left to assist the military in the Aleutians. Gillam hired several well-known bush pilots to fly heavy loads to Northway, including Fairbanks pilot Frank Barr, future Katmai pilot Johnny Walaka, and Cordova's Merle Smith. Northway Airfield and the establishment of the Northern Air Route that facilitated the internationally significant Lend-Lease program was, perhaps with the exception of Kennecott, arguably the most nationally important, the least known event to occur within the vicinity of Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. To honor Bob Reeves' vital participation in the project, the federal government christened the old Nabesna Field Reeve Field. Now, Smith, too, was treated as a hero after he borrowed the ADA to ferry supplies to Shoshana to save starving miners, elderly men forgotten by war and time. And at age 40, Harold Gillam died tragically too, albeit heroically. 1943, he crashed the Morse Knudsen Electra, saved one passenger. All were rescued. Gillam, injured, hiked out to try to save them, and rescuers found his body wrapped in a parachute with his long underwear hanging as an X, hoping to attract attention, his one last act of heroism. 5 years later, another aviation tragedy struck the Wrangells. On March 12, 1948, Northwest Flight 422, en route from Shanghai to LaGuardia, stopped in Anchorage to refuel. After taking off from Anchorage, the DC-4 reported its position over Gulkana. Then it disappeared. The aurora was intense that night, and perhaps because of this, the pilot flew the plane directly into Mount Sanford. All 300 on board were killed. Although this was the worst crash in Alaska aviation history, overshadowing the tragedy were rumors that the 24 U.S. merchant seamen killed in the crash were allegedly carrying gold bullion in payment for delivering a tanker ship to Taiwan. Rumors sparked numerous expeditions for so-called buried treasure. In 1999, commercial pilots Kevin McGregor and Mark McMillan located the crash site. Though they found no gold, their discovery did bring a modicum of closure for the families and the crash victims. The event also underscores the lingering promise of Alaska's golden dreams. And like Buffalo Bill himself, Smith reorganized and recognized that the newly arriving tourists considered Alaska's unique history, its culture, and natural grandeur as being exotic, even foreign. But Smith soon recognized that tourists needed no explanation when it came to experiencing Alaska's last frontier. Smith established what he called Cordova's Sourdough Tours, which flew tourists in his newly acquired DC-3 from Anchorage to ghost towns like McCarthy and Kennecott, places that reminded him not so much of the Klondike, but another tourist attraction of the day, Knott's Berry Farm. And even though Kennecott was a remnant of an industrialized giant that mined copper and represented the titans of corporate America, Smith's sourdough tours, not unlike Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, tended to celebrate the quaintness and the romanticism of the last frontier. In his promotional campaign, Smith took a few liberties with historic fact while offering visitors what he called a real frontier experience. So I just want to point out this awesome brochure, but you know, this is Kennecott, the massive copper mine, and what's this guy mining for? Gold, right? But don't you love the people taking pictures? In McCarthy, of all places. So without a doubt, and rightfully so, Alaska historians and public consensus consider Gillam, Reeve, Kirkpatrick, and Smith unsung heroes. Reeve and Smith both went on to run successful and modern airlines, yet neither forgot their modest and Alaskan origins. But similar to the romanticized cowpunchers of the American West, Eastern Alaska skyboys have also been idealized by popular culture. Contrary to the sky boy narrative, the landscape over which they soared was indeed magnificent and dangerous, but it was never empty. Over the centuries, the land had been occupied by ancient Atna and visited occasionally by Russian promyshleniki, American explorers, hopeful miners, railway operators, and empire builders. Moreover, the Wrangell's early pilots may have been pioneers, but they were not independent. They relied entirely on big business and the federal government, whose symbiotic activities at the time constituted Alaska's real economic development. Flying supplemented mining interests. Pilots flew into roadless mining camps, equipment, labor, mail, and they flew out the ore. Without the federally created Alaska Road Commission, which constructed airstrips in order to support mining development, aviation in the Wrangells would not have been possible. Similar then to the incorporation of the American West, the partnership between corporatism and the federal government was crucial for the growing and the expansion of the regional economy as well as its aviation frontier. Though critics argued that the federal government interfered too much in Alaska aviation, others believed it did not intervene soon enough. During aviation's initial years, a kind of free-for-all, as I mentioned, ensued, depicted by many writers as a kind of Wild West. But instead of creating a healthy, competitive business model, a lack of regulatory oversight caused rivaling pilots to price their services unsustainably low. To make up for those losses, rates for passengers and freight fluctuated constantly, making business arrangements with potential clients shaky at best. Little control over their own flying businesses, combined with a fierce contest for customers, forced pilots to take off in the worst Arctic conditions. Flyers who survived the night flights, the frigid temperatures, the blinding storms were treated like heroes by residents of the communities they served. As the stories multiplied, the bush pilots moved into the realm of aviation legend. More times than not, bad weather and treacherous landscapes caused pilots to crash, in which they lost cargo, planes, even lives. It seemed that in those first few years of flight, the legendary status of pilots was equaled only by their mounting debt. The post-war years changed aviation in Alaska in significant ways. Romantics say that it brought an end to the golden age of frontier flight, while realists point out that it brought safe, efficient, and reliable air transportation to the territory, including eastern Alaska. Besides regulatory oversight in 1938, the war produced modern airfields, and thanks to wartime industrial productivity, more powerful aircraft. With the exception of Bob Reeve, the independent flying businesses began to merge their planes, pilots, and prescribed routes after the war to make their services more efficient and, more importantly, more profitable. Still, even with the arrival of the age of the airline, the sky boys of the last frontier did not fly into the sunset and simply fade away. The post-war generation of flyers pushed the envelope of aviation in eastern Alaska even further by adapting their businesses to niches unique to the Wrangells. Some, like University of Alaska Fairbanks president Terrace Moore, again, more a science explorer than a mountain man, yet Moore's mastery of high mountain landings proved to be essential in providing air support for a research observatory on top of Mount Wrangell. Not only did Moore make historic landings on the Wrangell's highest peaks, but UAF's mountain laboratory studied everything from cosmic rays to the interaction of glaciers and active volcanoes. The work conducted by these international researchers, supported entirely by aviation, was the impetus for the Geophysical Institute, which ultimately established the University of Alaska as a world-class research facility. Adding to aviation's scientific effort was the Copper River Survey in 1950. The surveying work, funded by the Alaska Road Commission, was supported by pilots, particularly Cordova Air's Herb Haley, who landed and took off from sandbars. Another post-war skyboy was Jack Wilson. Wilson, who personified the independent loner, followed trails blazed by Bob Reeve. In the mid-1950s, Smith hired Wilson to fly Cordova's mail route. But in 1956, Wilson branched out on his own, refusing the tamer career path to airline pilot. Instead, Wilson became a fly-in hunting guide in the wild country of the northern Wrangell Mountains. Indeed, at a time when planes were renowned for getting bigger and sleeker, they were also getting smaller and more agile. In 1959, Wilson's flying service started ferrying hunters from Anchorage to Gulkana. When not guiding, he prospected for good sheep hunting guides in his Super Cub. The fly-in hunting trips proved so popular that other air carriers started flying hunters into the area. Not surprising, with the increase of post-war sportsmen, the sheep population declined. Although resident flyers tended to practice a fair chase sportsman ethic, not all newcomers were so mindful, and as Wilson later lamented, in the Old West, men had exploited the riches of the new country, and we were no different. Besides sheep hunters, mountaineers used Jack to fly to the most inaccessible parts of the Wrangells, which still maintained some of the highest unclimbed peaks in the world. And by the 1960s, a revolution in outdoor equipment had made it easier for climbers to access wilderness. Adventurers just two decades prior slept in heavy canvas tents and ate bulky canned food. Technological breakthroughs intended for soldiers improved climbing logistics exponentially, providing the wilderness traveler lightweight equipment such as insulated clothing, durable tents, and freeze-dried foods. Adding to the popularity was better transportation systems abroad, which gave the climbing community at the time an international flair. Wilson aptly called the 1960s the decade of the mountain climber. While increasing modernization during the post-war years drove wilderness seekers to eastern Alaska's Copper Belt region, the desire for new minerals to fuel the nation's nuclear age attracted scores of geologists northward, hired by big development firms to prospect for valuable ore. The revival of the mining in the Wrangells created the need to continue bush service into the Copper Belt region, subsequently attracting a new generation of flyers. It also introduced a new technological tool, the helicopter. By the 1970s, helicopters had replaced the prospector's horse and opened new areas in the Wrangells to mineral exploration. But just as aviation had made natural resource development increasingly easier in the Wrangell Mountains, an unprecedented surge in wilderness conservation had ignited the nation. Wilderness advocates began to worry that helicopters made wild places vulnerable to overuse and exploitation. In 1980, the United States Congress passed the historic Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, which created the Wrangell St. Elias National Park and Preserve. In the end, sports hunting could only be conducted in the preserve, airplanes could not be used for subsistence hunting in the park, and because helicopters were not considered traditional and customary, such aircraft was prohibited entirely in what became by far the nation's largest national park and preserve. Even with the establishment of the park, pilots and planes continued to serve the residents of Wrangell Mountains. In the horse country of the White River area that drains the north flank of the Wrangells, McCarthy pilot Gary Green would fly out in the fall to tend to the mares and the fowls. He would even return with rather uncommon but very cute cargo, little baby horse. Although in the 1970s, aviation represented a modern industry, pilots remained meaningful to the communities because their lasting activities reflected traditional values and ideas, ideas that many people believed unique to the last frontier. but also in very real ways, they allowed these frontier people to stay connected. Since the late 1920s, particularly after Kennecott abandoned the railway in 1938, pilots kept the dwindling populations that huddled near the Copper Belt airfields linked to the 20th century. Even after industrialization and mechanization sparked during World War II, Alaska pilots still flew over a brutal landscape, which demanded superb human know-how and skill, not to mention a high level of competency and problem-solving talents requiring one to get out of a tight spot. This is on top of Mount Wrangell, the volcano, 14,000 feet. I would just be like, I'm toast. Today's Wrangell Mountain pilots, like their predecessors, are very aware of the natural environment in which they do their jobs. They continue to provide rural communities access to economic systems, commodities, and medical care. They provide people living in the shadow of Wrangell Mountains a sense of community, while at the same time, they allow those same residents the opportunity to hold on to that frontier ethos. Instead of miners, it's now rangers, biologists, archaeologists, and historians who depend on these pilots to provide them access to the park's hard-to-reach places. And they also provide modern wilderness seekers access to some of the most isolated places on Earth. Indeed, the Skyboy narrative and its varying views of aviation in the Wrangell Mountains is simultaneously compatible and in conflict, and sometimes transcends historic fact. But what my efforts ultimately hope to explain is how the Skyboys brought Eastern Alaska into the modern age, while at the same time personified such Alaska qualities as resourcefulness, innovation, and ultimately inspiration. A feat, to us non-flyers, can only be described as indescribable.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with National Park Service historian Katie Ringsmith. Her talk on Wrangell Mountain Skyboys, how Buffalo Bill, Buck Taylor, and Bob Reeve created Alaska's Skyboy narrative was hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society and recorded at the Anchorage Museum on April 18, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. Special thanks to our UAA intern, Evan Erickson, who recorded and edited this week's program. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.